Chapter 6. John Barleycorn, whom Ben called J.B., looked like a bent nail. From years of toil in all kinds of weather, arthritis had twisted his back, and yet he lifted 200-pound kegs with ease. His pale blue eyes radiated fatigue, and his face, as tough and tawny as leather, bespoke all the years he'd spent laboring outdoors. A pork-pie hat never left his head. Ben, having once worked at Pensgrove for DuPont, knew a lot about boilers. With this experience, he'd helped J.B. put together his new still. They'd remain friendly because the two liked to make music, J.B. on the banjo and Ben on the mandolin. Sitting in J.B.'s kitchen, I learned of Ben's interest in folk songs and his skill on a musical instrument. I suppose he was shy about his ability, or ashamed to play hillbilly tunes in the presence of Mr. Schneiderman, who listened only to the masters. Like so many Americans, J.B. lived far from the American dream. His house was no more than a shanty, and his clothes roughly handmade. All his furniture tottered, a broken leg here, a lost crossbar there. He had hardly a chair that wasn't missing a spindle. The tattered curtains hung over sooty windows. The so-called rug was old towels sewn together. Everything in the house said, "Where is money?" Worse, his wife and only son had both died from TB. Their losses were still much on his mind. "I can't figure out why it should have been them. I've always been God-fearing, except for the making of whiskey. And to tell you the truth, I'm willing to bet that old Jesus himself took a nip once or twice in his life, what with all them Romans snapping away at his heels." Trying to fit in, I remarked that the making of whiskey didn't look easy. But it was the wrong thing to say, because it started him stewing and speechifying. "It's not a life of sunshine. No picnic, I'll tell you. It's nothing but hard work and the very hardest. You stay outside and take all kinds of exposure. If you ain't got a shed over you, and I ain't, and it rains, you stand right there and take it. If it snows, you stand right there and take it. If you got no way to ride the stuff out of the woods, like me, you just got to walk it out. Ain't no lazy man gonna make no whiskey. I hear a lot of people say, 'So-and-so too lazy to work, all they do is make whiskey.' They ought to try it sometime if they think it's a snap. Carry the sugar into the woods and the ground is wet and slippy and you're falling and you're stumbling and you got to chop wood and it's wet and you're trying to get a fire and run that stuff and don't know whether you're going to bump into the revenue or not and have to pack that stuff back out of them woods. It's a Luciferian job." Ben told J.B. that Claire had worked for the U.S. Army in France. J.B., a Stars and Stripes patriot, judging from the slogans like "America for Americans" and the plaster statuary of national monuments that clutter the house, said he was prepared to risk his neck for any woman who'd been willing to risk hers for the good old U.S. of A. From outside, he fetched a pole, hammer, and nail. "Take that piece of torn cardboard behind the rocking chair," he said to Claire. "And with this charcoal, write in large block letters, 'Repent in dust and ashes.'" Giving Claire a big wink, he hammered the sign to the pole and told us we'd better get moving. We were now well into Tuesday. J.B. led us down little-used trails and across numerous creeks as we tramped through the vast stillness, broken only by our singing of the Methodist hymn, "There is a fountain filled with blood," which J.B. insisted we learn. "Whenever you're in a tight spot, just start singing. Works like a charm." At last, we could hear off in the distance the sound of a river. J.B. led us to the spot we requested, where we'd last left the raft. Lying high and dry on the bank, it looked hardy enough to stand a journey through snapping turtles and snakes and the inky black waters of Lupkin's Pond, south to Millville and the Delaware Bay. We thanked J.B. for his help. Ben and I shook his hand. Claire planted a kiss on his cheek. "'Twasn't nothing," sputtered J.B., pawing the ground with his foot, just like a kid. Once on the raft, we drifted slowly downstream through country that Indians had previously canoed. Claire remarked that the quiet on the river reminded her of the privacy and peace she sought as a child. I wanted to write and had no room of my own, so I fixed a board in the branches of a maple tree and, sitting on an adjacent limb, used the board as my desk. My mother wanted to cut down the tree. Claire paused and looked rueful. But I'll say this for that loveless woman. The pleasantest memory of my childhood is of her reading to me in the evening. As we rode the dark river toward Union Lake, the sun began spilling through gaps in the trees. Ahead lay Tumbling Dam and the city of Millville. We hugged the east bank, even though we'd be passing a crowded amusement park. To the west, the road ran to Carmel. Displaying our sign, we soberly greeted a few canoeists listlessly paddling and some fishermen in rowboats sitting motionless, holding fishing lines attached to colorful bobbers. We saw a few cottages on stilts at the shoreline and passed the carcass of the Millville Furnace Foundry, where in earlier times they used to make cast iron pipes. Near the shore, the sun-dappled water shone bronze, and the pebbles glistened like gems. Pretty soon, we drifted opposite Union Lake Park, where the young roller coaster riders howled with delight while the Ferris wheel patrons, a good deal older, sat sedately. At the merry-go-round, parents stood sentinel as children clung to the poles of their rising and falling horses. Along the boardwalk, couples walked arm in arm, and on the pier, revelers hailed as we passed just a few feet away. In front of us lay Tumbling Dam. I could hear the Bridgeton-Millville trolley steaming through the wood toward the lake. Hissing and rattling, it ran across the top of the dam and stopped at the wooden footbridge to discharge passengers on Sharp Street, the dirt road that lay just south of the dam. A number of strollers, enjoying a view of the lake, leaned over the rail and called to us as we slid toward a path that provided good portage. Several people pitched in, helping us lift the raft from the water down the incline and across Sharp Street, where we re-entered the river and continued downstream to the city center. The Wednesday morning market was in progress, and the town crawling with farmers. People ran to the bridge and to the banks to watch our approach. Claire stood and held aloft the sign, while Ben and I sang, "There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains." The good men of Millville must have been touched, because when we pulled over to dock, a number of them came forward to assist us. Moments later, Ben and I embraced Claire as she prepared to continue her trip to the Delaware. Waiting till she drifted out of sight, we headed back to Carmel. When we reached the farm, we learned that during our time in the swamp, before Mom and the Princess returned, nothing was taken, except for some of Mr. Schneiderman's pamphlets with speeches of Eugene Debs. The prof, though, had been arrested and taken to Vineland, where he languished in jail for several days before the princess, who seemed in no rush, secured his release. The three of us immediately set to work in preparation for the great outdoor seance 2 days hence. My part required that I show up at the actual event wearing a hoop skirt, cut extra large, so I could store a birdcage and concertina underneath. As the princess scissored and sewed, and the prof twisted wires, I was let in on the secret of the make-believe arms. I'd always wondered how the princess could keep her arms on the table and yet have them free to do tricks. Harriet told me about controls, those people sitting on either side the medium assigned to control her arms and legs, who were easily tricked or corrupted. But in this case, the answer was simple. She had a pair of false arms. Hollowed out and strapped to her shoulders, they allowed the princess to remove her real arms as soon as the lights were turned off. Although artfully crafted and colored, the bogus limbs probably escaped notice because once the princess appeared, the sitter's eyes were fixed on her bosom. With her hands free, she could reach under the table and grab all sorts of props. But I was still mystified as to how she could store props under the table when the prof always invited sitters to look. As the outdoor seance approached, the prof went off to lecture at one of the churches in Vineland on the truths of spiritualism. He'd been angling for weeks to land an invitation. Finally, Pastor Bunsen, known for his burning speeches against Bolshevism, had thrown him a line. The prof was delighted. You could tell from the way he introduced the princess's seances that he relished an audience, so I knew that playing second fiddle to his wife's popularity must have chafed. He felt that as the better educated of the two, he deserved to hold center stage. Mr. Schneiderman guessed his motives were commercial, to drum up interest in the forthcoming seance. Frankly, I don't care a hoot for motives. They may matter to policemen and pastors, but I say judge the man by his acts. Motives, they're not worth a bucket of warm spit. Pastor Bunsen picked up the prof in an old jalopy, and with the princess pleading fatigue, the two of them drove off to glory. A few minutes later, Malcolm Bird showed up. Hearing raised voices surprised me, because usually they were tangled in amorous nets, not in argument. Running upstairs to listen, I came in on the line, "Not a chance, Birdie." "What's so awful?" he plaintively asked. "Just forget it." "I naturally assume this is what we both wanted." "Not another word," the princess insisted. "Just because I want to tell my wife I've met someone I care for very much," the princess anxiously interrupted. "On the basis of a few stolen moments, you intend to break up your marriage and mine."
"You make it sound cheap."
"It's the cost, all right. I'm not about to give up my mission so I can live in a clapboard house in Vineland on a reporter's salary."
"But all those times," said Mr. Bird, disbelieving. "What were we doing?"
"Entertaining ourselves to get through the long, hot summer."
"Was it nothing then but a game?"
"Everything's a game, Birdie. What matters is how you play."
"But you have nothing in common with the prof." The princess broke into a laugh.
"Birdie, why spoil the good feelings between us by falling in love?"
"Since when does falling in love spoil love?"
"When it means living on $12 a week in a burg. Besides, in case you hadn't noticed, I'm hollowed out like a Christmas turkey. Now you know."
"But why? He's your husband."
"I needed a bag for my tricks, a hiding place."
"You can't be serious."
"Shh," she said, placing a finger on his lips. "A few days from now, we'll talk again."
Little did they know that the next day would divide them forever. The night of the seance, the princess and prof could be seen in Naravlansky's field, just outside Carmel, rigging up a table with a row of candles around it, and off to one side, a frame with a curtain, which looked like an outdoor shower stall. Now that I knew the source of her props, it all sounded ghoulish to me. I could understand why, on a bright summer's eve, with the area lit by candles and torches, she performed behind a curtain. That night the field was just about full. The prof had roped off a large area and at several points posted parishioners enlisted from the church where he'd spoken to collect 5 cents a head. 8 people, counting me, were seated at the table. The princess waited inside the stall while the prof gave a speech about the afterworld, praising his wife for those incomparable gifts that empower her to cross over. He bragged, to beat the band, about his friendship with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and the poet William Butler Yeats, who both believed in the spirits. "I enjoy their company," he said. "Whenever the princess and I return to Europe to visit her Russian relatives and to perform before royalty, kings, dukes, and dauphins." At last, when he'd got everyone's expectations sky high, he signaled to me. Reaching through side slits in my skirt, I played a few notes on the concertina, causing quite a stir. The prof explained that the spirits had selected one of the sitters as the conduit for their celestial music. That was the cue for the princess to appear. Wearing a red robe, which she slowly let fall, she turned full circle to display her physical charms, dressed only in her gossamer gown. Well, talk about grand entrances. All these God-fearing folk let out such groanings and sighs that you would have thought it was the hour of the rapture. The princess seated herself, and a minute later, as usual, fell into a trance. Walter talked about the war and the dead and said some pretty nasty things about Huns. You had to hand it to the princess. In those days of anti-German sentiment, Walter knew just what to say. Trading on Claire's ideas, she spoke of workers and women's rights.
"Somewhere among us," rang out the gravelly voice, "there is a man who suffers from the worker's disease. You have been warned not to embrace your young daughter, lest she contract your disease. Yet you can't keep yourself from kissing your daughter. But every time you do, you feel more pain than the consumption because you know you are infecting your innocent child."
To my surprise, this story fed a number of men who loudly swore to the truth of it. The princess had won over their hearts and had them believing, until Walter spoke of equal rights and marriage.
"I see a man who treats his wife no better than a lady of pleasure. Whenever the animal that growls in his groin wants feeding, she complies or else suffers his fists. They have numerous children, all of them hungry. The poor woman can hardly stand on her feet. She is expected to take care of the family, take in sewing and take pains to honor her husband. Well, in heaven, we have a different view of marriage. In paradise, a woman is free to choose the size of her family, free to express an opinion, free to divorce her husband without losing her children. If you want paradise on earth, it will not come about until women enjoy the same liberties as men."
The fickle crowd, composed mostly of men, grew terribly surly, shouting their disapproval, cussing, spitting, and accusing her of being a fraud. Not far off, I could see Malcolm Bird madly scribbling away on a pad. The next day's headlines danced through my head. "Medium says divorce okay in heaven." The prof's Adam's apple was going up and down like a pump. He looked so distressed, I was afraid he'd pop out of his collar. Trying to quiet the crowd, he announced that the princess would now wake from her trance, bringing forth proof that the spirit world lives. That meant the magic show was about to begin. The princess opened her eyes and acted as if she had no idea of what Walter had said. Pointing out to lascivious smiles that she hid no tricks on her person, she retired to her own curtain stall. Ectoplasm in the form of a hand rose into the air. A harmonica trilled like a bird, my signal, to release the caged dove hidden under my skirt. Taking flight, the bird flapped its wings over our heads, and as if by direction circled once, rose, and disappeared into the night. I felt mighty relieved to be rid of that bird, which I'd been feeding seed to prevent it from chirping. The Hicks liked this sort of entertainment. I suppose it accorded with their view of heaven. When the prof announced that the princess would miraculously summon forth the sound of the Archangel Gabriel's trumpet, the men started hooting and hollering. Having had musical training, the princess could play all sorts of instruments. The surprise was that even though it was small, she could make a miniature trumpet fit into her storehouse. She tooted away, playing scales, Amazing Grace, and Yankee Doodle Dandy. The rumpus immediately quieted down, the men having forgotten their angers. But when she put away the instrument, some snoopy kid poked his head under the curtain and wailed,
She's a playing herself.
The crowd, misunderstanding, took it to mean something dirty.
It's a sacrilege, someone cried, mixing seraphim and sex.
That was all the others needed to hear. They pulled down the curtain stall, discovering the princess in a shocking position. Before you could say presto, the crowd had led the princess and prof off to a wagon on which they were ordered to stand. Someone produced a keg of molasses and an old feather mattress. A toothless man drowned the half-naked princess and the elegantly dressed prof in syrup, and a no-neck hick opened the mattress, letting loose upon them a cascade of feathers. The princess and prof looked unlike anything human. It made me sick to see it. Led off to the Vineland station, they were made to buy two tickets for Philly. For all their sins, they'd easily brought more pleasure to people than pain, and they were no greater charlatans than any of the other cuckoos running around. Human beings can be awfully cruel. When I got home, I told Mom that the princess and prof would not be returning. I didn't say why. Her only response was, "One of the birds died this evening. Jimmy found it."